Papa writes to Johnny, but Johnny can't come home. No, Johnny can't come home. No, Johnny can't come home. Mama writes to Johnny, but Johnny can't come home, 'cause he's been on the chain gang too long.
My name is Eileen Catalano, and I have the AIDS, and I'm dying from the AIDS. I am waiting for an operation. I don't expect for the prognosis to turn out very well. This is my life story.
High sheriff and police coming after me, and I feel like I got to carry on.
I met Eileen Catalano early in 1994. A friend brought her over to my apartment. He'd heard some of the poetry she'd been writing and thought it ought to be recorded. I set up my tape machine and started rolling, but instead of reading her poems, Eileen launched into the story of her life.
I was born in a carnival trailer in Norristown, Pennsylvania in 1948. My mother was a dancer in a sideshow in the carnival, and my father worked a thing called a rollback. It's a crooked wheel with a foot pedal under the rug for suckers.
And after a couple of minutes, I stopped my tape recorder and asked Eileen if she might be interested in recording her entire life story. She said yes.
I can tell people the absolute truth because I have nothing left to lose. There's nothing that anyone could take from me. I'm an old lady now. All right, and I allowed myself to experience life because I'm a fearless personality, okay? And not even death scared me. That's why I'm dying at a young age, is because death did not scare me. I did what the fuck I wanted, right up to the very end.
For the next several months, Eileen and I got together once or twice a week, going through her life. We made it as far as the age of 14 in her story, when she became too sick to continue taping. She died 2 months later. Eileen's stories were vivid. They were hard and horrifying, often poetic, always disturbing, as I learned in our first interview, when Eileen began her story by telling of her earliest memory.
When I was 5 years old, my father molested me. When my mother came home from work, I couldn't even get my mouth open. All right, I could not say a word. All right, I stood there and I looked at my mother, and my mother looked at me until finally it started to dawn on her, okay, what had happened. And I saw a part of her wake up that I had never seen before. All right, and she stood up. And she snatched two big handfuls of hair off of her head. She ripped them right out of her head. And she screamed a terrible sound, like a person who's been mortally wounded. And I was like, Mommy, you know? And I was trying to fix her. And I couldn't. She was all the way broken. All the way broken. She went in the kitchen and she got a hatchet, and she started sharpening the hatchet on a whetstone. And we had to sit on the couch and listen to that whetstone being passed over the blade. I knew she was going to kill him. Hey, when he came home, he seen her right away out of the corner of his eye, man. She was hiding behind the refrigerator with the hatchet. And she chased him out. He just barely made it out to the car. She was chopping her way through the roof of the car because he locked the door. And he managed to get away. My mother came back in the house, and we all sat in silence in the living room for a long time. And then my mother started to cry, and she cried all day, and she cried all night until about 4 o'clock in the morning. And then she got up and she took the Bible into her room, and we fell asleep on the couch and on the floor. I never talked about my story, never, until after I found out that I had the AIDS. I would think about the things that happened to me when I was getting high and I was in the galleries and the, you know, bars. See,
A drug addict is a person that lives in the theater of their mind and their emotions, and they amp that with drugs. All right, in these galleries, we're the mentally ill and the misbegotten, okay, and the abused and the degraded sit and play games with hypodermic needles to forget. Okay, that's how I remembered.
We were like, you know, sleeping in a car, and I lost all track of time. It might have been 3 or 4 months we were living in the streets, you know? And, I mean, my mother would go into bars. We'd sit in a car, me and the baby, and my mother would go into bars and pick people up and bring them out to the car and rob them. Okay, with a knife. Okay, and it seemed to me she really wanted to kill somebody. And I don't know how long that went on. I don't have, because I was so young. You know, my concept of time is like silly putty in there. But eventually, she went in somewhere, and we seen a squad car pull up, and she didn't come out. Okay, and then she came out with the police, and she walked them over to the car where we were and told us to get out. Okay, and then they took her away and they took us to Dade County Orphanage. My aunt came to take us out, me and my baby sister. They left my older sister in there. And I remember being on the airplane, right, and it was at night. And when we looked, it was raining or something. And when we looked out the porthole, it was so black. And I was overwhelmed by a feeling of fear. The blackness out the window. It was the blackness. Oh, there was nothing. I looked out the window, there was nothing. And I had this terrible feeling of doom and dread.
I had a compulsion to run, and I didn't know where I was going. But I couldn't stay at my family's house. I couldn't. I'd wander off. I'd get up in the middle of class in school and walk out the door and be gone for like 3 weeks. I got put in reform school by the judge for being an incorrigible child. Very unusual, all right? I went in when I was 11. There was only like maybe 2 other girls that were there that young. After I was in there a couple of years, the social worker called me in and told me that my mother had committed suicide. And, I don't know, like, it was weird. I remember trying to cry when they told me, but I couldn't. The sound, it was like a... When somebody is really spiritually hurt, they make a weird sound. And a sound that scared me really bad. I remember listening to the sound coming out of me. And I said, I'm going to die if I let this sound come out. So I choked it off, and I just sat there, and the social worker ran across the side of the table, and she was trying to get me to cry or to, you know, have some kind of reaction, and I wouldn't do it. I got up and left. A couple days later, right, I cried in my room by myself. I wouldn't let anybody see me. And my whole fucking body turned blood red all over.
okay? Everything swell way up. My fingers fat like this, like little baby fingers, okay? Little fat cigar fingers. And the house mother said to the doctor, what has she got, man? You know, her mother died recently in the last few days, and we've been keeping her in the house. What is that? And he said, I don't know. He said, it looks like some kind of severe allergic reaction. But today I know it wasn't an allergic reaction. It was because I held that sound in. All right? When I held that sound in, it had to come out. Yeah, and it came out. You know, death is... Man, it can be real hard. Okay, once the process of dying starts, if you begin to resist it, wow. You'll experience things physically that you wish that you didn't have to experience, all right? I mean, it hurts. I'm physically in a lot of pain. Okay, after a while, your vision of everything is distorted by the pain. And everything that you view is through this net of the pain.
After my mother died, they decided to relocate me to a foster home. Right, it was a Catholic foster home. And I started trying to do good in school because now the focus was on academic ability. So I started staying in my room a lot and trying to study and you know, and really learn so that I could be accepted by people for, you know, being smart or writing a good essay or whatever. And I was able to do that, you know. I was smart. But I was lonely.
I went with a traveling salesman, I guess he was. I was walking home from school. And he was very handsome. And had nice clothes. And he stopped his car. And he offered me a ride, and I got in. And we were talking, and I liked him. So he was, like, asking me some questions about sex and stuff. And I told him, I haven't had much experience, you know. So he said, well, I'll tell you what, you know, I'll learn you what I know, and I'll give you some money. I said, yeah, how much money will you give me? He says, I'll give you $100. I said, okay. So we went to this motel in the afternoon, and it was really nice. He was very sexy and very gentle and playful. And I thought to myself, that's what this is supposed to be like. You know, I thought it was all about like something a lot different from this. All right. So I realized that at that point, you know, that there were people that obviously used sex in a way to create pleasure and joy and not pain and sorrow and humiliation and regret.
I started changing, and I knew that I was a whore, and I did the best I could to accept that this was to be my fate. I'm actively in the process of being consumed by death. Okay? It's like right in front of me. I'm standing in front of the fucking Grand Canyon, poised for the dive. And it's a grieving process. You watch yourself die. Your different selves. And with some of them leaving, it's a real sorrow. It's like losing a friend. You know, and then with other things, it's like, you know, I'm glad I got rid of that.
I lasted about a year at the foster home before I burned down their house and slit my wrist and had to go back to court again and go to the nut house. This is called Green Tile Walls. I hate green tile walls, you know. They're cinder block, big, thick, green cinder block tiles, the kind that build institutions. They take on an unearthly hue under fluorescent light, so the faces of the residents are stricken, pale, and shocked. The quality of sound distorted so that voices almost echo against those tiles. The sound carries like in a zoo. What a place to learn to sing, to beat our voices against those walls in an effort to find some freedom. I hurled my voice against those walls. Agonizing raw sounds of the blues, I stretched my voice like a bird in flight, finding the range of its movement to hear some redeeming sound besides the cackling of mad women. Freedom is a space inside your heart.
And the very last words that Georgie said was, "Nearer, my God, to thee."
I used to sing almost like every day. I mean, after a while, I had to find something. There was nothing. I mean, it was just like, there was nothing, all right? It was the most barren environment that I've ever seen, all right? So I took to sitting in the corner of one of the hallways where I could get, you know, an echo. I would sing, "Don't let me cross over love's cheating line. You belong to another, and you'll never be mine. Well, I'm now one step closer, would be heaven divine. And don't let me cross over love's cheating line."
And the fucking nuts would start crying. Okay? I mean, the sorrow that would fucking come out of me when I stopped crying and I started singing. And people would always bother me, man. All the fucking nuts. Even the nurses started bothering me. They said, "Eileen, will you sing that song that you sang?" And I'd be sitting in the hallway singing all fucking night. Now my death is right. It's sitting right on me now. It ain't gonna be much longer. But it's okay. I'm finished. All right, it's over. And I came out of it as a real human being. And that's all I could ever ask for.
This is where the interviews stop, April 1994, Eileen had a collapse and was admitted to Roosevelt Hospital. At this point, we suspended recording her life story, hoping she'd recover enough to pick up where we'd left off, to learn about the rest of her life, her journey from the psychiatric institution, which was in Maryland, to New York City at the age of 14, her life as a prostitute, junkie, and criminal, poet and thief, sometime rock and roll singer. Eileen was diagnosed with the HIV virus just 1 month after she shot heroin for the final time. She was clean for the last 8 years of her life. While the pain made it too difficult for Eileen to focus on her past, she insisted on keeping a tape recorder by her bed so she could try to keep a journal. Often, at night, she'd have a nurse tape a microphone to her chest so that she could record her thoughts as she was falling asleep.
Hi, this is Eileen, and it's May the 6th. May the 6th. And I'm in Roosevelt Hospital. I'm here about a month already. I feel strangely depressed. I hate talking when I'm this depressed, but I'm gonna do it. Hey, I am depressed because I'm frightened. I'm very frightened. And I don't know if I'm gonna live. And I don't know if I'm gonna have a life that's worth living if I survive this shit. See, these medical people have a way of giving you all these promises. But a lot of their promises are lies.
Here, come over here, darling. Come over here with me.
I am Anissa's aide here, and I wish in my dear friend a happy birthday and many, many more, and hope that you would be a little stronger after this day, and hope that you will have many, many more birthdays. All are you now?
I'm too old now.
All are you now?
That morning, get by somehow.
Eileen Catalano died on June 3rd, 1994.
Don't let me cross over love's cheating line. You belong to another, and you'll never be mine. I'm no one step closer.
would be heaven divine. But don't let me cross over.